everybody, and welcome to Second Sunday Books. This is Libby Hellman, and I've got a great show tonight, or today, or whenever you're listening to this podcast. A book was just released today. It's an anthology. It's called Shattering Glass, and the brainchild behind it is Kelly Stanley, who is my guest tonight. She conceived the idea for Nasty Women Press right after the 2016 election and commissioned this anthology. It took a few years, but here we are. You'll notice there's a little technical snafu as we begin our conversation. It was my fault. Anyway, Kelly starts out by talking about my story in the anthology, which was very sweet of her. Here we go.
Stellar contributor to the book, your story, Daddy's Girls, is a very disturbing and moving piece of short fiction, and it was a highlight of the book. And I'm hoping obviously as many people as possible read this book because it's money toward a good cause. Every bit of profit from this completely volunteer-led, volunteer-driven nonprofit press and book is going to be donated to Planned Parenthood. And when they read it, I know that Daddy's Girls will be picked up as being one of the stories that's the most moving in the book.
Well, thank you. It was my darkest story, and I know it was definitely disturbing, and you did a fabulous job editing it. I mean,
you're
a wonderful editor. You made it much better.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I thought it was pretty great to begin with, but I know that the caliber of what we're trying to do with Shattering Glass is so high. That was a difficult process for me.
Did you edit all of the stories?
Yeah, we had a team of editors, three of us, who went through passes. Each of us did a pass because as editors, we're going to be looking for different things. And some people are going to be more on the line of sort of copy editing type of questions, and other people are not, are going to be on the more of the lines of developmental. And I'm more of a developmental editor. I'm looking at the actual writing craft. And the reason that's what sort of my wheelhouse is as an editor is because I'm a faculty member at Book Passage, at the Book Passage Mystery Conference in Northern California. So I'm used to seeing, you know, people will meet with me during that conference, which of course this year was canceled, but you know, you go through a draft, you go through a segment of a manuscript, and you're trying to really see how you can punch it, how you can straighten it out, how you can make it a more seamlessly written piece that would be, you know, perfect for submission to an agent or to a publisher. So yeah, it's a tough process, but it did give me a chance to have a hand in what I needed to have a hand in to make sure that we had a sort of a threshold for the book, and everybody in that book is so immensely talented that it's not like, you know, I had a whole lot to do, but it was fun to be able to make sure that we're sort of all on the same page.
Well, let's go back a little bit and talk about how it happened and how you founded the Creative Resistance and how that turned into Nasty Women Press. And I know it started the night of the 2016 election, because I think you and I emailed the next day and we were both on the floor in tears.
Yeah, exactly. That November 9th, 2016 was definitely one of the worst days of my life. And as an only child who lost both of her beloved parents within a month of each other to cancer, that says a lot about, you know, how bad that day was for me. I really was just devastated because I thought that maybe America had turned a corner to some degree with President Obama's election. I never expected, to be honest with you, to see an African American elected president in this country, because I have never turned, I've never done anything other than be very aware of the extent of racism, the pervasive systemic extent of racism in this country. In fact, it is implicit in what I write about personally. It's implicit in my books. I discuss it. I write about it. I address it because I really, racism and white privilege are two things that just, related things that just,
how did that happen?
Bother me. How did that happen? My parents were very progressive for their age and for their era, and I was raised in a very diverse, even as an only child who lived in somewhat remote areas, I was raised with quite a number of diverse people. So I was taught by my parents and through their example, respect and acceptance and recognition. And so when I ran across racism, which the first time was when I was being babysat by a white girl in Washington State, and she used the N-word, and I had no idea what it meant. So I asked my parents when they came home, and I rarely saw my dad that angry. And wow. He called her parents and probably took a couple years off their lifespans. And needless to say, that little girl never came back. And I'm sure they didn't have anything else to do with her parents. And then we later moved to Florida, northern Florida. My mom thought Florida was all like Miami Beach, apparently, and it's not.
When you get out of Miami, it gets different.
There's a big difference between Tallahassee and Miami. And so they arrived. It was sort of part of the back to the land movement in the 70s, you know, and they got we ran into what was a profound experience for me at the age of 7. We ran into what racism looks like, what it leads to, the not just systemic racism but systemic poverty. I remember they were looking for property, and they went to see this property, but there was a sharecropper on this property. Now, I didn't know what a sharecropper was, you know, but I knew that she was a very nice woman who lived in objectively horrible conditions. Not that it was dirty, she kept the place clean, but it was like a cardboard shack, essentially, that she was trying to raise the kids in. My parents would not buy that property because they knew that if they did, she would be booted off of it. So they didn't buy that. I didn't know this stuff at the time. All I could tell you as a 7-year-old is I could feel the pain. I could feel the horror. I could smell the smell of poverty. And it seeped into my senses. Later on, my father stopped along the back road and helped a black guy whose truck had broken down. And I remember I was with my dad, and I remember the man being really frightened. And I didn't know why, because he's a black man on a dirt road and a white guy stops to help him. That's why. And my dad brought him and his family over to our mobile home where we were living on this on the property that they did buy. And my father got death threats at work. On another occasion, my mother in Florida, this is in 1972, so this is supposed to be past segregation. My mother was paying a hospital bill, and she was in a waiting room that was just terribly maintained, you know. Furnishings were tattered, and drapes were rotten, and it was a filthy little room. And she was waiting in line, and she, you know, wasn't really paying much attention. And there was a white woman behind the counter, and she saw my mother waiting in line. My mom happened to realize that she was in line with a lot of African Americans. And the white woman looked at my mother and says, "Oh, you're not supposed to be here. You know, let me take you somewhere else." And my mom's like, "What? I'm here to pay a bill." The woman takes her out and takes her to another waiting room for white people. This is in 1972. My mom hit the roof. I mean, she was from Chicago. when she was young, she used to sing with some bands. She sang with the Dells. She knew Mahala Jackson. She and my dad used to frequent a lot of the blues clubs in Chicago. And they were progressives of the time. And my mom hit the roof in Florida, and she called whoever she could call, and my mom never got angry. This time she exploded. So those are just three of the things that happened. I did have the opportunity to attend mostly mostly black school is in second grade. And to this day, I am so grateful for that experience. It was a wonderful experience. It was much more welcoming than the mostly all white school I wound up having to be in when we moved closer to Tallahassee after they bought their property. And the teacher that I had was the first person to hand me a mystery. She gave me a copy of The Ghost of Blackwood Hall, which is a Nancy Drew book. And so I let's just say from a very young age,
right.
I became aware on a visceral level, and then later on an intellectual level, but on an emotional visceral level, I understood racism.
Let's get back to 2016 and the election.
So 2016, I saw what Trump was doing as a student of history, it was hard to ignore. It was obvious to me he was taking a playbook directly out of Hitler's 1933 run, and even earlier than that with the rise of the Nazi Party. He was actually being a fascist, and I was using words like people. He's a fascist in all my social media communications. And I know I had friends who were thinking I was probably exaggerating, but yes. He's really a fascist.
No, I had friends who thought I was crazy. They really were concerned for my mental health.
Yeah, I know. It's like, and we're like the, we're the canaries in the coal mine. We're saying, wait, people, wake up. This is dangerous. This is something funny. This isn't entertainment. This is fascism in action. So when he was elected, after everything, after mocking people with disabilities and bragging about being a sexual predator and obviously, as I said, stoking white supremacy and everything else that he did to advance autocracy and fascism and racism and sexism and, anti-Semitism, on and on. I was just floored. And I looked around at my friends and colleagues, and everyone's in a state of shock. Everyone seems to be in grief, but rootless at the same time. And I had an idea. And the reason I had this idea, I think, is both personal and just because it's the way my mind works. Personally, I wrestle with something called CPTSD, which is called complex. It stands for complex post-traumatic stress disorder. And essentially what this means is I get fight or flight triggered very easily. So my impulses with Trump being elected, my danger impulses went sky high. I mean, it was like definitely, it was exploding past red alert. Both for myself personally and for the country at large. And I thought, I can't just do nothing. I can't flail. I have to either run or I have to fight. And my mind conceived, it just sort of came to me when I was looking at people who were looking for something to hold on to. I thought, we need to hold on to each other, number one. And number two, there will be a lot asked of us in the next 4 years. And for some people like me with CPTSD, it's going to be difficult to take this to the streets. Some of us can't march, not because we don't want to march, but because it puts us in too much danger for one reason or another,
right.
or because you're working or you don't have the time, you can't, financially you can't afford. I mean, there's millions of reasons why people can't get out there or feel endangered when they do, or too endangered when they do. But they still want to be able to do something, to resist, to unify and fight back against the danger we see so clearly. So I thought sometimes the best way to protest is when you can protest by doing exactly what you normally do. In other words, if you're a plumber and you can protest by plumbing, how good is that? And if you're a writer and you can protest by writing, how good is that? And if you're a reader and you can protest simply by reading a book, how good is that? Mm-hmm. So in that moment, Nasty Woman Press was conceived. And I thought, we need to get together. People who write, people who read, people who edit, people who design covers, people who copy edit, everyone within the giant, you know, circle of creative people within the publishing entities. And it would include, and my vision included artists and graphic artists and anyone who would, you know, seeks to create something and promulgate it to the world.
Right.
That we bind ourselves together. We do what we normally do. We create, but we create something for the resistance. And then we sell it to people. And in the selling of that product, that book, the book itself can A, raise money for more nonprofits that are going to need it, and B, raise hopes of people who need to read this so that they know, no matter where they are, if they're in Alabama or if they're in New York or if they're in Seattle or they're in Topeka, they're not alone. That there are people who've got their backs. If they're mm-hmm. an island of blue and swarming in a red state, they're not alone. And that is really, really important, spiritually, emotionally, psychologically, for any resistance movement. So I've sort of refined the idea to be one where the product has a theme. Because, you know, if we have a true anthology, it's going to not just be crime fiction. It's not going to just be fiction. I mean, obviously, the peeps I reached out to were within my own community of crime fiction authors, because that's my network. But, you know, we managed to get some people who are not with, you know, who are beyond the crime fiction community. And the idea has always been to cast as wide a net as possible, to get people who write, whether it's they consider it literature, whether they consider it crime fiction, whether they consider it horror, a genre of any kind.
So
we wanted to incorporate.
Your idea of having nonfiction conversations and essays was there from the beginning?
Well, the idea of having it as broad as possible was there from the beginning. And what I was thinking of is that some people are so busy and are, you know, as the demand on best-selling authors is tremendous. There's a demand to keep, you know, turning out a book a year and or more.
One book? I was going to say.
Yeah, I know. And it can be really, really hard to, like, try to even squeeze anything that's thoughtful. The creative energy dries up because it gets overworked. So I thought it'll make it easier to get people on board who, if we tell them, look, yeah, you may be best known for fiction, but haven't you always wanted to write an article? Haven't you always wanted to write something else? How about doing something nonfiction? How about telling us who your favorite nasty woman is, which is one of the features of the book? You know, I was able to interview Barbara Boxer, a senator from California, with that question. So,
what
you know.
What did she say? Well, I haven't read it yet. What did
Rosa
she
Parks.
Say?
Rosa Parks.
Okay.
So, you know, the idea is to make it, as I said, as wide as possible, not just in who we're trying to reach, but in what they had to say. If people had something to say, and they could say it in a nonfiction way, when they didn't have time to craft it in a fiction way, great! You know, so we really wanted it, I really wanted this to be in a, you know, a true anthology format. So what happened is we sort of went from being a sort of scrappy collective idea that's very broad, and then we got the backing of Allison Davis of Davis Wright Tremaine, which is a tremendous law firm that's nationwide, who did a lot, I mean, pro bono work for us. They helped us incorporate. They helped us become a 501c4 company, set up a board of directors. We had to, you know, write bylaws and mission statements and design a website.
It took like a couple years to get all of that rolling. And I think you had some health issues in the middle of it, didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I, the thing about CPTSD is because of the fight or flight thing, it has a very negative impact on your constitution and your system, because your body's at this, the hormonal levels are really bad for you. Let me put it that way. It's sort of like being poisoned with adrenaline, because in adrenaline you kick in something to counter the adrenaline that's even worse for you. So what was happening to me is I was not doing well because of the Trump situation, and because my fight or flight was in high
always.
Gear and was not always. Relenting. Right. It was like
right.
It couldn't turn off.
I get it.
So, yeah. So, therapy has helped a great deal. I can't recommend that enough. Personally, thus far, I find it very difficult to go down the pathway of choosing a pharmaceutical to calm that impulse, because I'm a writer first and foremost, and I depend on my subconscious in order to write. My subconscious has to be free roaming. That's where the creative impulse comes from. And I tried, a pharmaceutical for like one day, but my brain was like, no, we got to find other ways to calm myself down and to calm down the effects of CPTSD. So yeah, there were bumps along the road for sure. We had a lot of people who left. You know, we had significant departures, people who were committed to it, but because it was taking so long, it's like, people start off, I want to do this, I want to do this, and then it takes a long time.
Did you know how long it was going to take?
No idea. No, that's why, and in between, we also do a call for submissions, if you remember.
Right, I remember.
Because one of our right? I know. One of our platforms on our mission statement is to try to get underrepresented voices in these books. So we thought, well, hell, we'll start with this book and, let's do a call for submissions. Obviously, in order to make the book a seller, we had to do a lot of invited, please be in this book, please be in this book, please be in this book kind of thing. Because we need to get, we want to get enough name recognition, authors who want to be who can be involved in there, so that people will notice it. But we, as I said, we're committed to making sure that underrepresented voices and people who have not yet been published get a chance to be in here, to get their voices heard. So that took a while, and then of course there was the solicitation of contributions. That takes a while, and then there's the editing of contributions. That takes a while, and throughout this process we had a number of key people, board members, editors, leave. And when that happened, it's like every time that happens, you're like, is this ever going to actually materialize? The core group, the core of us, we stuck together. Many people held on until they could get a replacement. And here we are, the idea. Yeah. And, the idea is that even though the content is so far flung, I mean, everything from the really dark story, excellent story that you contributed to, say Maria Alexander's story, which is hilarious, and so is Eric Buettner's. So there's, there's a wide range of of all kinds of sensations that you will get, as well as obviously being moved and informed by the nonfiction. They are tied together. The pieces are tied together by a theme, which in this case, of course, is the empowerment of women. The theme itself is what is the clue as to what we're raising money for. So the empowerment of women is tied into raising money for Planned Parenthood.
Right.
When we do the next book, God willing, it will be another theme that may be tied to a different nonprofit. So say if we wanted to do the theme of immigration, we could then tie that into the ACLU. So that's the kind.
Or systemic racism.
Or systemic racism, right? So unfortunately, there are a lot of topics that we can choose. You know, that's the problem. But you know, by and large, the idea is to just we're united around writing about these myriad problems in this country and the globe, and then trying to benefit one of the on the ground fighting organizations that is battling the problem. And that's what we're doing.
Yeah. Well, I hope everybody who's listening tonight will go out and buy a copy of this incredible anthology. You will find something for everyone in it. It is really, the authors who are involved in it are just peerless. All my friends. What happens? What are you thinking of doing another one?
Well, that's our plan. I mean, that's what we were founded on.
Yeah.
So, you know, I need to take some time because I have not been able to push my own book and finish my own book because I've really just tabled it in seeing if we can get this sort of thing.
Here it is. Yes.
Birthed.
Do you have a picture of it?
You know, I forgot to print out a copy, but let me tell you this. The cover was designed by the former art director of HarperCollins, so it's
It's a wonderful cover.
Yeah. And, you know, as I said, we've got so many great people. I mean, Heather Graham, Valerie Plame, it was blurbed by Marcia Clark and Alifair Burke. It's an amazing book, and I am so proud of everyone in it. I'm proud of you. I'm proud of every one of those contributions. They are all from the heart. They are supremely interesting and captivating and moving and entertaining and elucidating. And as soon as we can take a nice long break.
Yes, go enjoy yourself for a change.
And we want to really move this book too. I mean, we're going to be promoting the heck out of it forever, and certainly on the way through November. Yeah.
It's an evergreen book. Okay, yeah. I have two quick questions for you.
Sure.
One is about the anthology. Was there any particular person or story or conversation that you did not expect to get and just thrilled you to death?
Yeah. One of my favorite movies in the last, God knows, 20 years was Get Out. And I thought it was absolutely and criminally robbed of the Oscar that it should have won for Best Picture. I mean, you know, that water movie that whose name is escaping me, which I also saw, I was like, yawn. Okay. Mm-hmm. Get Out was actually profound filmmaking. And my friend Rachel Hazel-Hall is a terrific writer from LA. She's also on the Book Passage Conference faculty. And she wrote this, I asked her to write a piece, and she wrote this tremendous, tremendous story that's not just about, as I said, you know, female empowerment covers a lot of angles. This isn't just about female empowerment. This is about racism in America. And it's like a cross between, Rachel has described it as a cross between Get Out and Single White Female. And this story, when I think about it, I get chills. There's so many great stories in here. There's Alexandra's story, Sokolov's story, New Girl. There's your story. There's essays like Heather's and Valerie's. I mean, there's just tremendous amount of stuff here. But Rachel's story, that was just to me because I saw exactly where it was coming from and I saw the similarities to Get Out. I was very, very, very profoundly moved by it. And that was that was something that I didn't expect to see. And I was,
A lot of people are commenting on it, on the reviews, which by the way, have been fabulous so far.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. I'm glad to see that. Like I said, you know, my story, was a reaction to Brett Kavanaugh's, mainly a reaction to Brett Kavanaugh's installation. And it's also an homage to, one of my favorite episodes of The Twilight Zone. So
which one? Which episode?
That's called, it's called Hysterical. Oh, I'm not going to tell you which episode.
Okay.
That would get, that'd give it away. But the name of the story is Hysterical. So,
okay.
But yeah. But you'll recognize it when you read it. Yeah.
Okay. The other question is, if you want to take just, you know, 30 seconds or so to tell us what you personally are writing and when we can expect to see it.
Oh, well, the first part's easy to answer. The second part, not as much, but I'll try. So what I need to finish that I, as I said, I haven't been able to write in a few months because of the lead up to this, as well as the pandemic, which has caused a whole lot of obvious disruption in people's personal lives. I was thinking, you know, you think ideally, oh, I'm going to be at home, so I can write, but that's not really how it works in real life. So the book is a departure for me from my Miranda Corby series, which is has been set in 1940 in San Francisco. I'm not abandoning Miranda because she is an iconic character, and I love writing her. But she's going to be, she's making a sort of transatlantic move, and while she's in the middle of that, I'm writing a book about Humboldt County, California in 1985. Now, I happen to have gone to high school in Humboldt and Mendocino counties, southern Humboldt, and in the early 80s, and I know this period, and I know the setting really well. It was at the height of the marijuana wars in this area, when marijuana was so criminalized by the Republican Governor Duke Majan at the time, that he actually founded what was then the largest national task force, militarized task force, against marijuana growth and production. And so you have this tiny little town in these tiny little places. You know, Garberville had maybe 2,000 people in it. That's one of the closest town to where my parents lived. And you have black helicopters flying overhead. You have men with machine guns. You've got, I mean, the criminalization, it was like the Prohibition era all over again. Because what had existed before that had been a sort of, yes, growing marijuana was illegal, but there were lots of people who did it on a mom and pop basis and would grow some for themselves and then grow some for other people. And it was very open and kind of common and sort of this quote unquote hippie subculture, right? Now, my parents never grew it and we weren't part of that subculture, but I was exposed to it. I saw it, and it wasn't particularly harmful, because nobody came along to say this is wrong, and if you do this, you're going to lose everything you have and go straight to prison. Well, that's basically what happened. As I said, it was like Prohibition. Mm-hmm. And because of the criminalization, mm-hmm. all the normal people, quote unquote, if you can use that terminology, who were not criminals, so to speak, the people, the mom and pop type of people, just average Joes and Janes, were not able, they quit growing because the danger was too risky. So a lot of them moved. They quit, they left. There was, you know, Humboldt was different. Humboldt was changing. There was not the same Humboldt. If they could get out, they did. And what took their place were real criminals, just like Prohibition.
Wow.
So the cartels, the drug problems in Northern California, the disappearing people, the unsolved murders, all of that.
You're writing about.
I'm writing it from my perspective. And it's a unique book. I'm calling it a combination of Les Miserables meets Jack Reacher.
Okay. This is pretty good. All right.
It's at least different. So yeah, the name, the working title is Red Harvest, which is an homage to Dashiell Hammett's mm-hmm. book of the same name.
Somebody else did a Red Harvest, I think. Older guy, Tom, and anyway, go ahead. I can't remember.
Yeah.
I'm having a senior moment.
You know, it's such a great title.
It is a great title.
Like I said, it's my working title, so who knows what it'll actually be. But yeah, I got to get it to my agent, who's been very, very patient while I'm working on Nasty Woman Press. But yeah, so I want to get this done. I mean, ideally, yeah, it's potential for a series. We'll see what happens. You never know. I mean, it could be a standalone. It could easily be a series. But
well, thank you. This has been a great half hour. I wish we had another half hour to chat, because you're fascinating and you're really interesting to talk to.
Well, likewise, Libby. Thank you.
Well, I know. I just got to listen. You had to do all the talking. Anyway.
I'm good at that, unfortunately.
You're good.
I think it's for being an only child. It's like you learn to talk to yourself from a young age.
Anyway, good. We are going to keep our fingers crossed on Shattering Glass. I know it's going to do well. And anything I can do to help you, you will let me know. And if we have to go door to door and wear our masks, we'll do that too.
Absolutely. Well, you're the best. And like I said, your story is tremendous. And Daddy's Girls is really, really something. So thank you so much for all that you're doing and for, you know, basically for writing and for being you. I'm proud to call you a friend, and I'm proud to call you a contributor to Shattering Glass.
Thanks, Kelly. And I feel the same way about you. So anyway, folks, that's it tonight. That's it today for Second Sunday Books. I'll be back again next month with another edition. So please have a wonderful summer, and we'll be talking to you real soon.